This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, heightened tensions between Russia and Ukraine. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. Whether it's Brexit, the Gilets Jaunes crisis in France, or even political turmoil here in the United States, there is no shortage of issues dominating the headlines. However, we ignore at our peril the ongoing destabilization of Ukraine by Russia, exemplified by Moscow's seizure of two Ukrainian naval ships and 23 sailors on November 25th in the Kerch Strait in the Black Sea. The crisis did not emerge from out of the blue. Analysts say it is the culmination of more than 6 months of growing Russian pressure on Ukraine, in contrast to 2014, when Russia surreptitiously sent, quote, little green men, unquote, in unmarked fatigues to Crimea, an integral part of Ukraine, as a prelude to its illegal annexation. This time, the Kremlin's forces acted openly under the Russian flag. In response to this aggression, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko introduced martial law for 30 days in much of Ukraine. He also announced a partial call-up of reservists for training, saying the country needs to beef up its defenses to counter the threat of a Russian invasion. Ukraine and Russia have traded blame for the naval incident, which has further escalated this tug-of-war that began in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea and backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine says its ships were operating in line with a 2003 treaty with Russia envisaging free navigation for vessels of both countries in the Sea of Azov and Kerch Strait. Russia alleges that the Ukrainian ships entered its waters without permission. Well, with us to discuss the escalating hostilities between Russia and Ukraine are Mark Simakovsky. He's a senior fellow in the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, a prominent think tank based here in Washington, and Will Pomerantz. He's deputy director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, and that's a policy group also based here in Washington. And both gentlemen, who are not strangers to these VOA microphones, join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Will Pomerantz at the Wilson Center, let me begin with you. What do you make of this latest attack against Ukraine by Russia? Give us a sense of the state of play and help us understand the conflicting accounts and what's really going on.
Well, the issue was who has access to the Kerch Strait. And since the annexation of Crimea, Russia has invested several billions of dollars to build a bridge that connects Crimea to the Russian mainland. And by building this bridge, it has essentially interrupted and stopped ships from being able to go through the Kerch Strait, which allowed previously for Ukrainian and Russian ships to freely navigate it. So there's now only one spot under the bridge, as it were, that allows for Ukrainian ships to pass into the Kerch Strait and into the Sea of Azov and to go to Ukrainian ports in Mariupol and other cities. And so what happened was that Ukraine was simply exercising its rights under its agreement with Russia and under international law to have its ships pass through the Kerch Strait underneath this bridge and go to ports in Ukrainian territory. And what happened was that the Russians decided that they would not allow for these ships to enter. It blocked the passage under the bridge and then rammed and seized the ships, thereby creating a major international incident because there's now the fear that the far eastern part of Ukraine, Mariupol and the eastern regions, are now cut off from the Azov Sea and the Black Sea and are isolated and won't be able to get their exports out of the country. So it's an international incident. It is a limitation on Ukraine's ability to use the seas. And it is a provocative act by Russia in order to prevent these ships from entering the Kerch Strait.
Mark Simakovsky, and it sounds like a manufactured crisis. How do you see this?
Yeah, I think I agree with everything that Will said, and he laid out the context of the event perfectly. I think the international context, as well as the domestic political context in Ukraine, is also important to understand the timing and the trap that essentially the Russians set for the Ukrainians. Russia, by building this bridge, understood that at some point there would be a moment of truth where it would be able physically to limit transit. But also, this bridge serves as political leverage for the Russian Federation to put more economic and political and, as we've seen, military pressure on Ukraine to undermine its sovereignty and territorial integrity. So at any moment from the building of this bridge, they have an opportunity to showcase that the Ukrainians are weak and don't have access to their ports and don't have the ability to export key commodities like steel and other things and coke and coal ash that Ukraine needs to export. And also they can use these incidents to undermine the government. Of course, this is happening as the Ukrainian government is preparing for presidential elections in the spring. The Ukrainian president Poroshenko is facing a difficult election fight with many different factions of Ukrainian oligarchs that are backing different candidates. Russia's actively playing a role in undermining the president and backing certain candidates. So this event has to be seen also in that domestic political context and putting pressure. But again, several months prior to this event, I think it is important to flag that there were Ukrainian military vessels that were actually towed through the Kerch Strait under this bridge, and they were allowed free access by the Russian Federation. So at some point, the Russian Federation chose that they would not allow this to happen again, or that they simply wanted to put more pressure. And again, this denying of access is paired with a de facto blockade that the Russians had slowly tightened on Ukrainian ships leaving, where we actually have dozens of Ukrainian ships backed up around some of the ports that Will mentioned in the Sea of Azov, choking the Ukrainian economy. Of course, as you can assume, no ship will ever be transiting that strait with the same confidence that they had before. And as a result, certain shipping companies are going to be making different decisions. Lastly, the international context I would flag. This occurred prior to a planned meeting between President Putin and President Trump in Argentina. I believe that the Russian Federation, this was a premeditated act to test the international community and the West's will in standing up to Russian provocations. And Putin wanted to see whether President Trump would continue to meet with him despite this provocation and to see what the EU and what NATO would do at a time when the Western community is divided. And so far, the community has not done much in response to this Russian provocation.
So back to you, Will Pomerantz, to talk about this premeditated act, as Mark characterized it, in a sense, to test the will of the West. So how has the West acted, in your view, or not? And what about Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko's immediate response, which was to introduce martial law for 30 days, call up reservists? This looks like a real crisis. How is Ukraine dealing with it, in your view, and the international community?
I think the international community responded with words of support for Ukraine. They also evidently must have informed Ukraine not to escalate this crisis. And what we've seen since these events that we've discussed is we haven't seen anyone try to test the Kerch Strait again. We haven't seen a real overt display of military force by NATO or the United States in the Black Sea and so forth. So I think, as Mark suggested, Putin was trying to see yet again what the response would be to any sort of action that Russia took in this region. And again, we've seen that the West isn't willing to engage militarily in Russia's backyard. There's no doubt that there's no political will in NATO to really begin testing this issue and test whether Russia will let them in. So I think what you've seen is strong words of support and recognition that Ukraine has the law on its side, but an unwillingness to test the facts on the ground. In terms of what President Poroshenko did, it was very interesting to see his attempt to impose martial law. And there are a variety of different interpretations as to why he decided to do it. But I think what it exposed was Poroshenko's political weakness in anticipation of this election, that here was a direct violation of Ukraine's rights. He wanted to galvanize the nation. He wanted to declare martial law across the country for 60 days. And yet when he tested the Rada, he didn't have that level of support that he needed to pass this through. Usually in moments of national crisis, there's a rallying around the flag, and one would have thought that President Poroshenko would have been able to accomplish that. So he wasn't able to get his 60 days and martial law throughout the country, which again suggests that the Rada was suspicious as to what he would do with martial law. So he got a much different package. He got martial law in essentially, I think, 10 provinces, and he only got it for 30 days. And the Rada extracted the promise that the presidential election would be held on March 30th. So instead of Poroshenko, I think, coming out of this crisis in a stronger political position, or at least demonstrating his leadership skills. He came out yet again rather wounded, that he wasn't able to control the Rada, he wasn't able to get what he wanted passed, and indeed to get the program that he received, he had to actually make concessions.
And of course, the Rada is the parliament in Ukraine.
Right.
Well, back to you, Mark Simakovsky, to, in a sense, answer your own question about how do you see the reaction by the international community. We're seeing lots of words of support. The U.S. House of Representatives just passed a resolution in support of Ukraine. But once again, good words, but no real concrete actions, just asking President Trump to hold Russia accountable for its aggression. And secondly, how do you see Poroshenko's position? Do you see him weakened? So if that's the case, well, then it looks like Russia's getting away with another assault.
Yeah, so first on the international reaction, that's obviously the barometer mostly is what is the United States and what is NATO and what has the EU done? I think overall the response has been underwhelming. I think the Russian impression is that, as before, the Western community of nations is not divided and not coherent on how they want to respond, and there's no stomach for a fight or any military response, as Will noted. I would say, though, there has been some elements that, when sewn together, could create a fabric of response to Russian aggression. First, I'll mention that politically, what Putin wants most is continued engagement with the United States at a strategic presidential level to address issues of mutual concern between the United States and Russia. One key element was supposed to be a meeting between the two presidents in Argentina at the G20. I don't believe that that meeting ultimately was canceled because of the fate of 23 sailors. That meeting ultimately was canceled partially because at the same day that President Trump was flying to Argentina, Mr. Mueller issued another layer of his investigations that put incredible political pressure on the president and on his administration, which again made it very risky to sit across with Putin as the president did in Helsinki and not be able to stand up to President Putin and criticize him, which I don't believe this president is able to do. So his advisors ultimately won over of the riskiness of meeting with Putin, and that was a blow to Putin because he enjoys the engagement with the United States. It's something very important for Russian national interest. So as a result, that meeting was canceled. Second is you have a new U.S. Congress who's coming into office in the middle of January, and this Russian provocation will only add fuel to the fire of those in the House of Representatives and in the Senate that are clamoring for more sanctions against Russia. Again, some of those calls are politically motivated to criticize the administration, but this attack that Russia committed will only reinforce that in Crimea, in Syria, in North Korea, Russia continues to take actions that are destabilizing and undermining of U.S. national interest. Lastly, the United States did conduct an extraordinary open skies overflight over Ukraine. This is a overflight that, again, is conducted with U.S. military aircraft, which is nominally conducted to inspect any place that they have a right to inspect, but they did that in a way that was unplanned. And I also believe that the United States is likely accelerating plans to deploy ships to the Black Sea, but I assure you that U.S. European Command is looking into ways of accelerating and potentially increasing to ensure that there's a rite of passage. Again, all insufficient, but there are steps that have been taken.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Will Pomeranz. He's deputy director of the Cannon Institute at the Wilson Center, a think tank here in Washington, and Mark Simakovsky, from whom you just heard. He's senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. And we're discussing the reasons behind and implications of the most recent escalation of hostilities provoked by Russia against Ukraine. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to a loyal listener, Daoud Abdulkadir Hussein from Mogadishu, Somalia. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our program about Russia's provocations in Ukraine. Back to you, Will Pomeranz. What is, in your view, Moscow's endgame vis-a-vis Ukraine? We hear Pedro Poroshenko saying that this is a slippery slope on the road to Russia's attempt to totally control or annex all of Ukraine. How do you see this? What is Putin's endgame?
Well, it's not easy to read Vladimir Putin's mind. So one obvious goal is that Crimea is Russian and it's never going back. So I think he's, from President Putin's standpoint, he's conducted his referendum. He's annexed Crimea as a part of the Russian Federation, and that's just simply not negotiable. So I don't think that you're going to see Crimea be put on the table. In terms of his larger endgame, it's always uncertain as to what he ultimately wants. If indeed Vladimir Putin wanted to take all of Ukraine, or a huge chunk of Ukraine, then clearly he could have done so in 2014 and 2015, when the Ukrainian army was in shambles, and clearly he had the military force to take more of Ukraine. Instead, he simply invaded eastern part of Ukraine and installed puppet governments in Luhansk and Donetsk, and kind of said that these are kind of autonomous, independent states. But he didn't necessarily want to annex them, and he hasn't annexed them. And I think there are a variety of reasons why he wouldn't want to, in terms of increased sanctions, increased responsibility for maintaining support of them, incorporating them into the Russian Federation. These are all kind of major decisions that, on a certain level, he doesn't necessarily want to make and doesn't have to make. I think Putin's primary goal in Ukraine is simply to destabilize Ukraine, that what he wants is he wants an ongoing conflict in the East where people have to always consider what are the chances of it increasing, what are the consequences of a larger battle. And therefore, what he does is he discourages investment into Ukraine, makes sure that its politics are divided, and makes sure that Ukraine doesn't emerge into a stable, democratic, free market economy. So his presence in eastern Ukraine, which is a minimum investment for Vladimir Putin in many ways, satisfies that requirement and therefore makes sure that Ukraine doesn't develop and therefore doesn't pose a political challenge to him in the sense that Russians say, well, if Ukraine can change and become a democratic, open, pro-European country, why can't Russia? I don't think he's necessarily looking to end this crisis immediately. There's always the question of sanctions and whether he can diminish sanctions even under the status quo. But I think his primary goal right now is to make sure Ukraine remains unstable.
How do you see his primary goal, Mark Simakovsky, in Ukraine?
First, agree with everything that Will said. I would add a few points. One, primary goal and a goal that I think has driven Russian foreign policy under Vladimir Putin is to prevent the encroachment of Western institutions, NATO, the European Union, closer to Russia's borders. So the Russian invasion of Georgia in 2008, the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2014 were all done ostensibly to prevent those countries from democratizing, changing their economies, and further integrating into the West. Despite both countries not being on the brink of membership in either institution of NATO and the EU before those conflicts, Putin wanted to take the opportunity presented with a Georgian provocation in 2008 and ostensibly what he characterized as a coup in Ukraine to seal those countries' fates forever from the Russian perspective. And so his goal is to prevent Ukraine from moving into NATO, and his goal is to prevent the Ukrainian nation from ever being a member of the European Union. So how does he do that? Exactly with what Will has exclaimed. Keep Ukraine destabilized, keep Ukraine unsavory in the eyes of the West, keep Ukrainian people questioning whether their country can become a normal state, which paradoxically, Ukraine and its leaders have allies in Moscow because they've taken decisions that has prevented Ukraine from eschewing its corrupt past. And in many ways, Ukrainians are victims of their own political leadership that has been unable to overcome some of these latent domestic challenges. The other piece, of course, is to use Ukraine as an example of Western weakness and to showcase to the Russian people, to the Ukrainian people, to any Russian neighbors that the West will not stand up for your interests, will not stand up for your security. And although Russia may not be your friend, it's the best partner you have, and you should align yourselves with the Russian Federation and ensure that Western integration only will bring ruin to your country. And in many ways, we ourselves are victims of our inability to stand up for some of these important partners at times of crisis, showcases our own weakness, and Putin is playing on that. But lastly, I think in a very kind of short-range effort, President Putin is trying to use these various crises, whether a land conflict in the Donbass, now sea conflict in the Sea of Azov, to solidify the gains that he made in 2014 at a time of Western distraction. You build a bridge, so when you build a bridge, you got to secure the sea waters around it. when you take over certain land portions, you want to potentially ensure that those land portions are secure. And so I think he's doing all those things in the guise of preventing Ukrainian access, but doing it in a way that solidifies his control over Crimea. And again, that's all a test to the West, and it's a test so far that we've failed.
Both of you have indicated that the West is very much divided, weak. We see, you know, Angela Merkel in Germany with her own problems, and Emmanuel Macron and the United States as well. And then we have this nexus that Marx and Makovsky alluded to, where we're looking at potential conspiracy yet to be properly documented or even revealed between perhaps members of the Trump campaign and Moscow. So this is all very murky, an atmosphere in which it seems like no one is really willing to stand up to Russia. So back to you, Will, to talk about how can the West raise the cost of Putin's aggression? And does the West have the political will to do so? Are there any number of measures that could be implemented that could threaten Putin and force him to back down?
Well, I'll address the issue of sanctions, and maybe Mark might want to talk about more military opportunities and options that might exist. But so far, what we've responded in terms of Russia's aggression is with sanctions. And there have been various rounds of sanctions, and Mark's correct. There is every possibility that this new Congress will want to impose more sanctions on Russia. Indeed, sanctions on Russia is one of the few issues that Republicans and Democrats seem to agree upon at regular intervals. I have no doubt that we could raise the level of sanctions. I think it's becoming increasingly unlikely that the Europeans will increase the level of sanctions. And I think the test that is before us is whether the Europeans even keep their sanctions in place. For the Europeans to continue sanctions, they have to approve them every 6 months unanimously. And leading up to this most recent vote in December, there is plenty of hints that Italy, which has changed governments, is not interested in continuing the sanctions. There are other European countries, Hungary, Slovakia, and so forth, that have also voiced unwillingness. But they've always gone along with kind of the German-French nexus that these sanctions have to be maintained. In the absence of Britain in the EU soon, but the issue is if the Europeans, for whatever reason, decide to roll back sanctions, and their sanctions are similar to our sanctions on individuals, on the oil sector, and on the banking sector, if the Europeans decide to roll back sanctions, will the United States find itself, like it is in Iran now, as being the country that supports strong sanctions, but doesn't have kind of global support in order to give them teeth? I think that's really the big test going forward.
Well, you get the last word, Mark Simakovsky, about what the West could do to raise the cost of Putin's aggression and if it really even has the political will and what are the ramifications if not.
You know, I think there's plenty more that could be done, some of which we're already doing. One is bilateral military assistance to Ukraine. I'll credit this administration for providing Ukraine lethal defense equipment that the previous administration refused to do in the form of Javelin anti-tank missiles. So just as we chose to respond to Russian aggression with defense equipment on land, we can choose to provide defense equipment by sea. Again, Ukraine has limited capabilities, but there are anti-ship missiles or other capabilities like radars, mines that the United States could provide to send a deterrent signal that continued Russian militarization of the Sea of Azov will be met with Ukrainian response. NATO also could increase its maritime presence in the Black Sea, establish a new maritime ship working group to kind of conduct freedom of navigation operations, again, in the Black Sea. I highly think it would be provocative for NATO to seek to enter the Azov Sea. The international community should seek to facilitate continued Ukrainian and Russian dialogue and to also raise Russia's violations of that 2003 agreement and do it in an international context. And ultimately, we have to continue to support Ukraine despite its challenges. And again, support any democratically elected leader of Ukraine. But Ukraine needs support, and we also continue to have to raise these issues. But there's plenty that more can be done to support Ukraine as it deals with Russian aggression.
I'm sure we'll revisit this issue in the coming year. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Mark Simakovsky. He's Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, and Will Pomerantz, Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights and analysis.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.